It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions for a second time. The Bucks beat the Phoenix Suns 105-98 last night in Game 6 at the Pfizer Forum in downtown Milwaukee, and it's the first time since 1971 that the Bucks brought the title home to the city. MVP winner Giannis Antetokounmpo scored 50 points during the game last night. Here he is speaking after the team won.
Thanks a lot. I want to thank Milwaukee for believing in me. You know, thank my teammates, man. They played hard every freaking game. You know, I trusted this team. I wanted to do it here in the city. I wanted to do it with these guys. So I'm happy. I'm happy that we were able to get it done.
What is your level of excitement about the Bucks this year? Were you in the Deer District last night? What was the crowd like? Did you feel the energy of the fans? Did you practice social distancing? If you're a fan tuning in from outside of Wisconsin, how did you celebrate the win? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Mitchell Maurer is the co-managing editor of Brew Hoop. That's SB Nation's community for fans of the Milwaukee Bucks. Mitchell, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Rick Schabowski chronicled the team's 1971 title season in the book From Coin Toss to Championship. Rick, thanks for joining us again on the morning show.
Well, it's a pleasure. What a historic day. I'm glad we can share some memories of what a great evening yesterday.
Well, let's stick with that, Rick. The last time the Bucks won an NBA championship title, that was in 1971, so 50 years ago. You know, what does a win like this mean for the city of Milwaukee?
Well, it's tremendous. Just to see just for sports fans, this is the first time ever a championship was clinched in Milwaukee. When the Braves won in 57, they won it in New York. And when the Bucks did win in 1971, they won in Baltimore. So this was a home crowd, an instantaneous moment that people could celebrate, and they did very well. And downtown was just very orderly. It was the Milwaukee's police did a good job. People cooperated. It was just packed, 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 but everything was well handled.
Yeah, and Rick, I want to get back to that, talk about the Deer District in just a minute, but let's talk about the game itself. So, Mitchell, you watched the game last night. You cover this. You manage this group. What were your thoughts about last night's game?
So last night was Game 6 and was actually kind of a mirror image of Game 5, where everything was flipped, where the road team was able to kind of claw their way back after the home team went on to a big lead early. The only difference is that in Game 6 at home, the Bucks had Giannis and the other team didn't. That was really what it came down to. The fact that Giannis scored 50 is a statistical marker of just how flat-out dominant he was and how he imposed his own will on the game and got to his spots, set up his teammates for success. And Phoenix just simply didn't have an answer on the court for what Giannis was doing in terms of scoring, in terms of defending, and just in terms of the entire flow of the game. The Bucks were able to reclaim the lead in the third quarter, and they never gave it up. It was sheer force of will, and they just hung on tighter than Phoenix could try to pry it away from them.
And, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo, he was injured about 3 weeks ago. He hyperextended his mm-hmm. knee. There was some question about, you know, what the rest of the season would look like, not just for him, but for the Bucks. You know, now that we're on this side of it, how are we thinking about, you know, that injury and really Giannis's role on the team?
It is unfathomable that a human being could have their knee get hyperextended to that degree and somehow come back and play professional sports at this level. His nickname is Greek Freak, and it's a well-deserved nickname. When he went down against Atlanta, like that, for most fans, that was it. That wasn't just the playoffs this year. That was the entire next season. It potentially, that could have been a career-altering injury. It could have been something that would have affected the franchise for the rest of this generation of players, because the way the salary cap works and the structure of the team's payroll, like, this is it. this is the team. Giannis is the leader, and he you know, he's earned his place there. But he's the best player on the team. He's a two-time MVP. There's no way for them to, like, make any changes at that level unless they just decide to trade Giannis, which is just a terrible idea. We won't even need to get into it. But they didn't have any other cards to play. Like, this is it. This is the team. This is the team that's going to come back. And the fact that he came back and was able to deliver such a performance in the NBA Finals and the Bucks were able to win the championship, now all of a sudden they're going to be among the early favorites to repeat next year with largely the same core of group of players.
Now, Rick, I want to turn to you. We've been talking about Giannis. He's got some standout teammates. Chris Middleton is one of the first people that comes to mind. Now, you know, you've been following the Bucks for a really long time. How does this team stand out maybe compared to teams over the last, you know, 20, 30 years?
Well, the big thing is after the Bucks won the title, nobody left that Fiserv Forum. Everything took place on the court and all the interviews were done. It was really great. And what's great about this team and any lot of other teams is the love everyone has for each other on this team. It was very evident in their post-game statements, Giannis, Middleton, everybody, and Bobby Portis, boy, a fan favorite. And the big difference in this team is also that sense of really community love for not only for each other, but for the city of Milwaukee and their fans. And also having that quest, that fire. And the good thing, another thing about this team is the deep bench. People can come in and really contribute. Bobby Portis, you can go up and down that lineup that people come in. Jeff Teague, he may not play a lot yesterday, but he contributed. Everybody contributes to victories for this team. And this is really something to really watch in amazement. In this day of pro athletes, there's a lot of cooperation, a lot of love, respect for the coach, respect for their fans. And like I said again, they really love their fans here in the city of Milwaukee.
We are talking to Rick Schabowski and Mitchell Maurer. They're both longtime Milwaukee Bucks fans. Rick chronicled the team's 1971 title season in the book From Coin Toss to Championship, and Mitchell is the co-managing editor of Brew Hoop. You can call in right now with your Bucks takeaways from last night or even from the season. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Mitchell, let's look at the season as a whole. For the entire year, was there any expectation that the Bucks would land where they are that we saw last night, or was it still up in the air earlier in the season?
I would say the expectation was that the Bucks were capable of landing where they did. But it wasn't a foregone conclusion. And you have to go beyond this past season to the 2 years that preceded it. When Mike Budenholzer took the lead role in Milwaukee, he had a very immediate change on the way the team played basketball. And they raced out 2 years ago and last year to the best record in the league, the top seed in the Eastern Conference, home court advantage, which ended up not mattering last year because of the pandemic. And this season was primed to be more of the same if they did things the same way, where they would be wildly successful in the regular season. And then when the playoffs came around, they wouldn't have the experience necessary to adjust and to adapt and to find ways to win tough games against tough competition and be disappointed at the end of it, which is what happened against Toronto 2 years ago and in Miami in the bubble last year. This season, they specifically and purposefully went out of their way to do different things to avoid playing their own style of basketball and specifically to experiment, to tinker, to try and figure out different ways of winning games, even especially because it pushed them out of their comfort zone. And so they lost a lot more in the regular season than they were expected, and that pushed them further down the standings, and it made it a harder path to actually get to the finals. They not only did they have to go through Miami in the first round, which was a tough matchup that ended up, you know, not being as tough as we feared, but still difficult. But they had to play the star-studded Brooklyn Nets in the second round, and they just barely got past them. And then it was widely expected they would have another tough matchup in the conference finals, and that's just to get to the championship round, much less actually winning the championship round. So the fact that they adjusted on purpose early on and approached the season, you know what, we're not going to just try to win as many games as possible. We're going to try to make ourselves better and make ourselves more flexible. That ended up making all the difference. If they hadn't done that, sure, maybe the chips fall a different way and they get to the finals, but I doubt that they would be as well equipped to actually win as they ended up being.
Do you think that the way that Budenholzer and the team approached it this year, you know, losing in the regular season more often probably than many teams would want, but, you know, that tinkering seems to have paid off. Do you think that that's unique to the Bucks, or do we see other teams do something similar?
I think it's something that other teams do. It's hard for me to say because I don't follow any other teams as closely as I follow the Bucks.
Fair.
But I think that teams understand that you have a very limited window with which to compete. And the Bucks are blessed to have a longer window than most because their best player is 26 years old and apparently impervious to any injury. Knock on wood as I say that. But I think the other teams recognize that they have a short window, and so they have to prepare. There's an adage that's in NBA circles that there's two different types of players, 82-game players and 16-game players. The 82 is for the regular season, and those are the guys that can get you wins, you know, night after night when the stakes are relatively low. But 16 is the number of games you need to win in the playoffs to actually seize the title, and those are the players that need to be able to perform under the highest level of pressure, under the most scrutiny against the best competition. And the fact that the Bucks actually went out of their way to deliberately prepare to be able to do that and season their own players to kind of do that, I think that is a rarity that I can't remember happening any time else in recent NBA history.
We are talking to Mitchell Maurer. He is the co-managing editor of Brew Hoop, SB Nation's community for fans of the Milwaukee Bucks, and Rick Schabowski. He chronicled the team's 1971 season in the book From Coin Toss to Championship. They're with us to talk about the Bucks' win last night. And coming up, we'll talk more about what it was like being on the ground at the Deer District. And you can call in. Were you there? Did you want to be there? Call 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're talking about last night's Buck versus Suns game. It was the sixth game in the NBA championship, and the Bucks brought it home for the first time in 50 years. They were crowned supreme last night. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a Bucks fan? Were you at the Deer District last night? What did you think of the game? We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Our guests are Rick Schabowski and Mitchell Maurer. They're both longtime Milwaukee Bucks fans. Mitchell is the co-managing editor of Brew Hoop, and Rick chronicled the team's 1971 title season in the book From Coin Toss to Championship. Now, Rick, from what I know, you've been a diehard fan for a long time. You have tickets, season tickets. You were in the Deer District last night. Break it down for us. What was it like being down in downtown Milwaukee? Certainly just in general, but as they won.
Well, I got there really early and it was already packed. It was mobbed all the way from Water Street west to the Pfizer Forum and all around. Just crowded, wall-to-wall people, but very orderly, very well-behaved. Now, I had tickets for the game, and I had to win, and it was a long line, long wait to get in. But what's another half hour when you waited 50 years? It was well worth the wait to get in there, and people were just, you know, talking basketball, really a frenzied crowd, just couldn't wait to get in there. And the staff at the ushers, everybody did a great job, like I said before, the police, and it was very orderly. There was a ton of people there, but everybody was respectful of that moment in history coming up.
You know, it's been a really tough year and a half. You know, crowds haven't been able to gather. Of course, there was some concern over the amount of people that were going to go. But what was it like being back in there? What was the energy like for you? What was it like just being with other fans?
It was just electric. It was deafening. People were just yelling and screaming, Bucks in six, whatever, tons of cheers. And, you know, lucky I can make this interview. I'm almost so hoarse. I mean, sure, a lot of other people are this morning. And my hands sore because even after the game, people just would slap five with everybody. And, boy, it was just electric. People honking their horns on the street on, you know, 11:15. But who cares? It was just bedlam. And, you know, well-deserved. The fans are very passionate. I think the love the Bucks show to their fans, actually the fans show it back. They're glad to have this team. And to a singular moment, really, to enjoy this championship, unreal. And then the Bucks, the fans stayed behind them. Like Mitchell noticed, it was the same kind of game where we fell behind. Boy, looks like happening. Just like the Bucks were down, but the Bucks got off, and they took a knockout punch, and they got up again, like they have through this whole season against Atlanta, the Nets, and everything. That was the resiliency of this team is really key. That's another benchmark for this team, that how they stood up to adversity. People forget Dante DiVincenzo was out also. He was an important player for this team and would have contributed. Injuries are part of the game, but the Bucks, like I said, continued to cover, to conquer adversity.
You know, WPR's Madeline Fox visited the Deer District last night to get some reaction from fans, and she spoke with Bucks fan Antoine Island last night. Here's what he had to say.
I'm excited. The city needed it. It's been a long time since we had it, and Giannis definitely needed it, especially all the work he put in.
And so, Mitchell, I'll go to you. Hearing from a local fan, I know you're from Milwaukee too. How does that resonate with you?
I think there's a certain level of validation to the Bucks winning this title, the way that they did it, because Milwaukee isn't a quote-unquote glamour market. It was something that was a very long-running topic of conversation, not just over the course of the season, but over the course of decades, about how to build a team, how to attract talented players, how to build a championship contender. And Milwaukee in NBA circles was largely an afterthought because people like on the level of LeBron James or Dwayne Wade back when he was playing or Damian Lillard or anybody who's at the absolute upper echelon of the sport, Milwaukee isn't high enough on their list of cities to go play in. With Giannis especially, he is not from Wisconsin. He's not from America. He's Greek. Was Nigerian and raised in Greece. But he is homegrown because he came to live in Milwaukee at 18 years old when the Bucks took a chance on him, and he gave the team his absolute all from day one. There's innumerable montages of him working out and practicing and lifting weights and just doing everything he had to do to improve himself, to hone his craft, to improve his own game. And we saw him I know that we got to see it following the team. We saw him grow before our very eyes. We saw him grow up from a teenager to an adult to a man. And, you know, he reached the pinnacle of his profession in Milwaukee after specifically re-signing to stay in Milwaukee. And so I think that because of that homegrown component of his journey and his story, I think that it just tastes a little bit sweeter. And he even said as much in his post-game comments to the media. Like, he could go to a super team and win a title. That's kind of taking the easy road. This is the hard way, and that's how they did it.
We're talking to Mitchell Maurer and Rick Schabowski right now. They're both longtime Milwaukee Bucks fans, and they're talking about the Bucks' win last night in Game 6, making them NBA champs. Now, Rick, one thing that Mitchell just mentioned was that it feels like Milwaukee is more on the radar now. Do you think that the team will be able to recruit more people, bigger stars, to really create a longer-lasting dynasty?
Well, it's a go-to place now for a player. Milwaukee has a really bright future ahead of it, hopefully. Giannis is very young, what he's accomplished before age 27. Middleton, they have a very good nucleus, a long-term team that can really, really stay around for a long time. And wanting to play for the Bucks is something that will happen now because they're championship caliber. They should be, like Mitchell mentioned, a favorite to repeat. And the nucleus is there. And any added pieces to this puzzle to help win games is really big. And the thing that impressed me yesterday, too, was the Bucks' defense. It was maligned during parts of the season, but they really stepped up. You can see them calling out, fighting through picks, picking up people, going for loose balls, diving. It was a lot of energy defensively, and that's something you don't see a lot in the NBA. It's more offense, but the defense of the Bucks really turned this thing around, and Coach Budenholzer does a great job, too. And you want to play for this team now because you want that ring. You want to be part of that trophy-winning team.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. There was a lot to get to. Rick Schabowski chronicled the Bucks' 1971 title season in the book From Coin Toss to Championship. Mitchell Maurer is the co-managing editor of Brew Hoop. That's SB Nation's community for fans of the Milwaukee Bucks. And they joined us to talk about the Bucks' win last night, making them champions, bringing back that title for the first time in 50 years. This is The Morning Show. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings up a story about the lessons learned on a family camping trip.
Taking the kids camping usually sounds like a great idea, until it's not. Author BJ Hollers brings us a story about the trials and triumphs of the family camping trip.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. With those famous words, Charles Dickens opened his classic novel, which, if you read no further, might very well be a book about camping. Ah, camping, the foolhardiest of summer traditions. The chance to dust off the tent, unfurl the sleeping bags, and pretend that you enjoy the outdoors. And all the better if you actually do. And we did, at least for a little while, as my children and I pulled into our campsite at Coon Fork Campground 30 miles east of Eau Claire. Standing at the edge of our site, we peered out at the glistening 62-acre lake, while overhead the birds welcomed us with song. My 8-year-old son shimmied beneath my left arm, my 6-year-old daughter took refuge beneath my right. Together, we all inhaled a gallon-sized breath of cool Wisconsin air. It was the best of times, indeed. Right up until the storm struck a few hours later, sending us speeding back to the comforts of our home. Warm beds never felt so good. Returning to our site the following morning, I was relieved to find that the weather gods had taken pity on us. Our tent had not become a houseboat as I'd feared, merely a waterbed. No matter, it was nothing 10 absorbent towels couldn't fix. Our return to Coon Fork the morning following the storm came with an added challenge. Our 9-month-old baby, who was destined to enjoy her first day of camping while my wife went off to work. Perhaps enjoy is too strong a word. Maybe endure is more accurate. Which she did, suffering little more than a forehead scrape after a topple from the cooler while Daddy extinguished an unplanned cookstove fire that had scorched our lunch. Best of times, indeed. When my wife and the puppy pulled into our campsite at day's end, she witnessed a scene pulled not from the pages of Dickens, but William Golding's Lord of the Flies. We were scraped, sunburned, hungry, tired, and trapped in a soggy tent. "How's it going?" she asked. The baby wailed. Sometime after midnight, I woke to the sound of my wife searching frantically in the dark for a diaper. We searched by cell phone glow as the baby's discomfort grew. "I think one's in the van," my wife whispered. Untangling myself from my sleeping bag, I high-stepped over the snoozing puppy, tripped on the lip of the tent, had a run-in with some overly confident raccoons, and at last retrieved the diaper as directed. Then I reversed course, passed those raccoons over the tent lip and atop the snoozing puppy. Proudly, I handed the diaper to my wife. "And the wipes?" she asked. I sighed. After that second trip to the van, I lingered on the edge of that star-filled lake stretched before me, listening to the nighttime serenade from insects I probably couldn't name. It wasn't the sound, but the stillness that stays with me, a stillness that seemed to neutralize the many mishaps that had compounded throughout the day. I took in one last gallon-sized breath before returning to the tent, where, upon entering, I saw my entire world snoozing safely together, a pile of legs, arms, and stuffed animals all woven together. I reached for my sleeping bag, only to find that the puppy had since commandeered it as his own. "Well played, dog," Well played. Finding a spot on the tent's damp floor, I reached for a towel, closed my eyes, and took my place in the pile. It was the best of times, indeed.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Right now, fans of Dungeons & Dragons will be able to visit a museum dedicated entirely to the legacy of the groundbreaking fantasy role-playing game. The Dungeon Hobby Shop Museum will have a soft opening today in the game's birthplace, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Now, are you a Dungeons & Dragons player? What do you want to know about the game's history and its creators? Do you have any special memories about playing Dungeons & Dragons with your friends? Call 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org, or you can send us a tweet at WPR Mornings. Jeff Leeson is the head curator and manager of the Dungeon Hobby Shop Museum. Jeff, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So in the intro, I mentioned that Dungeons & Dragons is a role-playing game. Can you talk about, just for the uninitiated, what they might experience if they play Dungeons and Dragons for the first time?
Well, for the first time, it'll be a little different because you'll be using six different types of dice. But one person runs the game. He's a dungeon master. He knows pretty much what goes on, and the other people play different characters, rangers with bows and elves and thieves and fighters and clerics and magic users. And then the players take the roles of those characters through the world that the game master has plotted his campaign on. And then it's not a game that lasts for any length of time. I've had a fairly active campaign going since 1976 as a game master. Yeah, so, and it's not a game of me against you. It's a group, it's for group companionship and group thinking and solving problems, and usually, for the most part, good fighting evil. Every now and then people play evil fighting good, but it doesn't work out because then there's pure chaos. But
So it sounds extremely collaborative, but it doesn't sound like the way we think about games typically, because a game is something that people typically set out to win. Is that, is winning a part of Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, yeah, you have minor wins. It's kind of like World of Warcraft, which is a computer game. You gain levels and you gain experience. Sometimes your character dies, sometimes he doesn't, but you gain experience, and most computer games now are based on levels and experience, and that's the huge tie-in with Dungeons and Dragons.
We are talking. Oh yeah, you did. Jeff Leeson is the head curator and manager of the Dungeon Hobby Shop Museum. And if you're a fan of Dungeons and Dragons, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How did you get into the game? What are some of your favorite stories from long games that you've had? Now, Jeff, how did Dungeons and Dragons come to be created in Wisconsin?
Well, originally it was Gary's father, I think it was, would tell him stories about wizards and castles and stuff like that. So it was, his imagination was pretty fruitful from the beginning. They came up with actually a war game. He and Dave Arneson worked on, kind of collaborated. Dave Arneson had some ideas. Gary had some ideas. Dave was not a writer, so Gary ended up writing Dungeons and Dragons. Dave Arneson did a little bit of writing. He's located in the Twin Cities, But so that's how it started in Lake Geneva. Gary was originally from Chicago, but then they moved into Lake Geneva because that's where family was. And then Lake Geneva became the mecca of gaming. So.
And what is your history with the game?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I started playing in high school. This will age me rather quickly. I started playing in high school actually in Boy Scouts in 1975. The game was produced in 74. So I started playing then. And like I said, I had my world. I've had my world campaign since 1976. But so in high school, Gary Gygax's oldest son, Ernie Gygax, was in orchestra. And then sophomore year, I went into orchestra. He played first violin. I played bass. Mm-hmm. We just became friends. I graduated in 1978, and he said, well, if you need a job, come work at my dad's company. I had no idea what the heck it was. I moved up north, helped my family finish building their house. When that was done, I came back down and started working in shipping. That was in 1978. I started working full-time. I was am the 17th employee at TSR, so I've been around for quite a while, I guess.
And since you do have a long history with the game and the company, what was it like working with Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson? What was that like?
Well, the one thing is we never had a chance to work with Dave Arneson. He'd show up at conventions and stuff, but then had a regular life to go back to the Twin Cities. But working for Gary was early TSR. It's so hard to explain how wonderful it was. You came in, and even if you're just shipping out games, we were such a small company and tightly knit and pretty much a bunch of intellectuals, as most D&D players are. Mm-hmm. And it just ended up, went off on a tangent and forgot what I was talking about.
Just working with Gary Gygax.
Sorry about that.
Oh,
yeah,
no.
Wonderful. So what we did is during the week, we'd work normal stuff, but we'd sneak up and watch the artists do art. On the weekends, most of us shared houses or rooms with other TSR employees, so then we'd play games all weekend. So it was basically you're getting paid to play games. And there were games going on all the time because we were play testing things to make sure that they ran smoothly. So I've had some pretty good jobs, but nothing has ever come close to TSR back in the day. It really, we didn't think anything of it. You know, it's first of its kind, and it's a game company. Okay, this is cool, working for a game company, but we never knew that it would just take over the world like it did. So we were pretty amazed.
That sounds really fun and a really fun history. We're talking to Jeff Leeson, game designer and head curator of the Dungeon Hobby Shop Museum. He's with us to talk about that new museum dedicated to Dungeons and Dragons. It has a soft opening today in Lake Geneva, and we will continue this conversation after a short break and take your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking to Jeff Leeson right now about the new museum dedicated to the fantasy role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons. The Dungeon Hobby Shop Museum opens today in Lake Geneva. That's a soft opening. And if you're new to the game, we want to hear from you. What do you like about it? If you've been playing for a long time, tell us about, you know, some of your campaigns. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Now, Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about the museum itself and the significance of the building that it will be in?
Yeah, I think the latter part is the coolest part. This was the original TSR building, the original TSR periodicals, which was Dragon Magazine, and also the original Dungeon Hobby Shop. This was the first office that Gary and Vice President Brian Bloom bought. Gary wrote Dungeons and Dragons in his house at 330 Center Street, and then this was the first business that they bought. Historically, game-wise, this is probably the second most important building next to 330 Center Street. What we've tried to do with the hobby shop is we've tried to pick up as many TSR products from the beginning, 1974, and since this building was used by the Dungeon Hobby Shop till about 1980-ish, we're trying to have a full collection of all TSR products during that period. We're missing just a couple pieces right now, but when COVID hit, prices on everything just soared, unbelievably so. Old products, old adventures that, you know, a month before that would sell for $100, $200, we're going for $500. So people are just scrambling to get stuff. And we don't know why, but that's okay. It helps us all out. So,
Jeff, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Matthew in Thorpe. Hi, Matt.
Hello. It's my favorite memory was we were playing Keeps on the Borderland, and me and another adventurer, we'd gone into the Sturge Cave, and we'd gotten lost in there, and some Sturges attacked us. And on the other side, the other rest of the group was exploring on the other side of the valley, and they got into some heavy fighting too. Well, they managed to come out, but the magic user could see us across the valley, and he was the only one capable of going ahead and still fighting at that point. So he grabbed the fighter's bow and arrow, and we did the calculations, and the dungeon master's like, this is the maximum range for a bow if you even know how to use a bow. And it's like, well, he's going to die, you know, if don't do something. So he went ahead and said, yep, I'm going to go ahead and maximum shot for a mage, and rolled a crit and stuck a Sturge.
Wow. Good shooting.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what he said. He could never do it again, but.
Yeah, exactly. One little, you know, rolling a 20 on a 20-sided die is just a wonderful thing. Matt, do you play 5th edition, or what edition do you play?
Well, I haven't played in several years because as a state employee, my rotating schedule doesn't give me a regular schedule to go ahead and get together with a group. So I'm hoping after I retire, I can go ahead and get back into the game.
So let me ask you really quick. I don't want to take anybody else's time, but where do you live?
Where's I live Thorpe? In Thorpe.
Which is
Thorpe is halfway between Eau Claire and Wausau.
Oh, I live farther north than that right now. I'm sorry for you, but if you can ever get down to Lake Geneva, you can come in. We're going to try to have a first edition game every week, a fifth edition game every week, and then a night of just board gaming. So if you
now, when you talk first edition, are you talking the original basic Dungeons and Dragons or advanced Dungeons and Dragons? Or
advanced
just Dungeons and
not
Dragons.
Original. Okay. Original is ODD. First edition is 1E. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're always more than welcome. You're probably rusty, so you forgot how to roll dice, and we can teach you how to do that. So.
Well, yeah. Thank you for that call, Matthew, and I hope you can meet up with Jeff soon in Lake Geneva to play. Now, you know, something Matthew brought up was that his schedule sometimes just doesn't allow for him to play. How has the game evolved? I feel like you can play maybe online now. Is that true?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, there's Zoom and there's Twitch. We're set up for Twitch right now. It's very odd to me because I'm not tech savvy at all, but we've been on we're on a couple games I've run. One or two are on YouTube. It's just D&D is such a game that if you don't pick up the pace and keep the people interested, the players even, they tend to get bored. So watching it online to me is the most boring thing in the world, even when I'm watching me run it. But I get where people are coming from, because if that's your only fix for D&D, go online. There's so much available. It's incredible. It's just incredible. COVID changed everything in the world, and that's including gaming, which is pretty fascinating in its own right.
You know, one of the things that stuck out with me from Matthew's call was the passion and the fun he had playing it. And I hear that with you. And if you'll indulge me a second, my brother is a huge Dungeons and Dragons fan. I mean, it really helped him, you know, make friends. Have you found that there's a big community and friendship that blooms from this game?
That's the coolest part of all. I've worked a few different jobs, most of them driving. But gamers, for the main part, are some of the nicest, warmest people. As long as you don't mind sitting down and listening about someone's character that he's had for 42 years, and he just goes on like for 4 hours, and that's a bit boring. I don't even do that anymore. I did when I was a fanboy back in the day. But I have friends from conventions, literally, that I met 40 years ago, I'm still friends with. And all I ever do is see him at conventions. That's how tightly knit our group is. We have conventions in North Texas, in Lake Geneva, in Madison, all over California, all over the place. And a lot of people, that's what when they take their vacations, they do gaming vacations. So they do it over a convention to get their gaming in. So, yeah, gamers were hurt during COVID pretty badly, only because we couldn't play. I wasn't struck that horribly because I hadn't been playing for 20 years, so it just was even sadder for me. But now I'm ready to play. I have my dice ready, and every day we should be playing games here. Or if not, you come in, and if I'm not giving a tour or anything, we can sit down and play a quick game. Awful Green Thing from Outer Space, Naval War, it doesn't have to be a TSR game. And that's just to bring people in, say, hey, this is what we're about. We're also like a gaming club. We want a safe place for everybody to come. Hopefully we'll get some kids, local kids in on a day I'll run like a first edition for older people and then a first edition campaign for younger people, just to get them used to it. A lot of times the older gamers don't like gaming with the younger gamers just because you have to explain everything, just like any game like that. But I taught, there was an event at the library that was hooked up with the Lake Geneva Museum, and I just happened to see that on Facebook, and I called up and I said, this is who I am. Do you need help with anything? It's like, oh my gosh. So I went over there, ran a game, and I had 8 players, and 4 of them had never played D&D.
Wow. So Jeff, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck on the opening of the museum.
Well, thank you so much. And even though I only recognize you by your voice, I would love to see your face walk through the door.
Thank you so much.
You are more than welcome.
Jeff Leeson is the head curator and manager of the Dungeons and Dragons, the Dungeon Hobby Shop in Lake Geneva that opens soft opening today. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.